From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, L.A. Noire. That's the new video game that virtually rebuilds Los Angeles. Now, some of you may remember this.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned to robbery detail. There's a potential killer on the loose in your city. 18 women have been beaten and robbed by this man. The newspapers call him the werewolf. Your job is to get him.
That's an opener from Dragnet, the hit radio, then TV series that was created in the late 1940s. The show invited audience members to think of themselves as sergeants working on a real crime in Los Angeles. Now, fast forward to this.
Julia Randall was found dead this morning.
She was a very beautiful girl.
Julia occasionally modeled for me.
She wanted it all, and she wanted it damn quick.
When you looked in her eyes, you knew how a mouse felt before a snake.
That's a trailer from L.A. Noire, a video game released today by Rockstar, the company that brought you Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption. It was created for Rockstar by Team Bondi in Sydney, and it is an homage to the Los Angeles depicted in noir films and hard-boiled pulp fiction. The game has been in production for 5 years, and in it, gamers get to play detective and investigate murders based on actual historical crimes. It's a video game, says design and technology expert Marissa Gluck, with unusually wide appeal.
What's interesting about it is the coverage it's getting outside of the video game community. It's getting covered by architecture blogs and urban blogs, and everyone is interested because of the design components, and then gamers are interested because of the technology and the complexity of the story, and then Mad Men fans are interested because it stars one of the characters from Mad Men. So it's crossing a couple of different worlds. So you have gamers and you have Mad Men fans and you have architecture fans and noir fans, mystery fans. I mean, it crosses so many genres in this one single game. And then you have the gameplay itself is incredibly complex. The story is multi-layered. It's highly narrative. It's, you know, we're talking about something that is almost cinematic. Though I hate using that word because it privileges cinema over games, and I think games have been cinematic for a long time. But I think this might be the game that convinces non-gamers that video games are capable of creating art.
In a moment, we will hear from Simon Wood, production designer on L.A. Noire, who'll tell us about the extraordinary lengths they went to recreate Los Angeles in 1947. But first, we call John Buntin. John is author of the book L.A. Noire, subtitled The Struggle for the Soul of America's Most Seductive City. It's about the turf war between gangster Mickey Cohen and the LAPD's chief, William Parker. Last week, John went to the New York office of Rockstar, and there, in what he described as a luxury gaming demo center, under close scrutiny from Rockstar staffers concerned about piracy, he spent 2 hours playing L.A. Noire. We asked him to review the experience, starting with an explanation of the gameplay.
L.A. Noire is basically a police procedural. You, the gamer, are Cole Phelps, a decorated war veteran with a dark backstory involving your activities in Okinawa during the Second World War. You've just joined the LAPD. And fans of the television show Mad Men will be forgiven for feeling like they're actually Ken Cosgrove, because Cole Phelps is played by the actor Aaron Staten, who played Ken Cosgrove in that series. So that's interesting. You know, this world that's been recreated in 1947 Los Angeles is an exquisite period reproduction, just as Mad Men is. And the gameplay consists of working through cases which were in many instances inspired by real cases that occurred in 1947 Los Angeles. And it's fascinating how they put you into the role of this character. This is not a game where you constantly look out through the character's eyes. There are many points throughout the game where when you are no longer needed to make decisions, the game goes into kind of a cinema or TV role. and you see your character, Cole Phelps, you know, moving through this world. You know, you can choose often how active you want to be or whether you want to proceed to the next stage of your investigation. You can choose to drive to where the clues have led you. You can choose to drive wherever you'd like to if you just want to explore the city. And you can listen to jazz or bebop on the radio. Rockstar's put together kind of a remarkably good album. You can even answer random calls that come in over your radio. When you find a clue, it almost always leads you to an address. And at the address is a person of interest or even a suspect. And whenever a clue is found, it goes into your notebook. And whenever a statement is made, you have a choice to believe the person, doubt the person, or accuse them of lying. You, the gamer, make that decision, and then the other character responds in keeping with what you chose to accuse them of, or perhaps what you chose to believe. And so it's a very interesting combination of intense high-stakes decision-making combined with this sort of opportunity to enjoy the kind of cinematographic experience of journeying through 1947 Los Angeles.
But this game is produced by Rockstar, which is famous for having produced the controversial game Grand Theft Auto, which I think relied rather heavily on just sort of zapping people with the Uzi. This game is played quite differently. Is that correct?
It is. This is not an action-driven game. It does have a lot of the signature features of Grand Theft Auto. You can get into fistfights, you can get into gunfights, there are high-speed chases. And it also does have some very grisly elements. But, you know, really what this case is about is looking for evidence and interrogating suspects and people of interest. And the game is very subtle and skillful in the ways that it does that. Some games will light up or throw halos around objects you're supposed to move to next. You know, this game guides you towards clues with a wonderfully evocative, noirish soundtrack that sounds like something that, you know, Max Stein might have written for, you know, The Big Sleep.
So let's get back again to the fact that this game, L.A. Noir with an E on the end, is situated in 1947, deep in the period that you, John, are an expert on. Tell us about how it was evoked in the game.
1947 was a particularly interesting time in the history of Los Angeles. It was a time when war veterans by the hundreds of thousands were moving to Southern California. And it was a time of considerable anxiety and, given the crime record of that era, considerable sociopathic behavior. Many returning GIs had experienced terrible things during the war. And while it's hard to realize, in 1947, there was a great deal of concern about what had happened to veterans. And there was a sense that the veteran returning to civilian society was a dangerous figure in many ways. And the game captures that moment very, very well. And the experience is really quite stunning.
Yes, I was going to say, I mean, how well, as someone who's really studied the era yourself, how well do you think they captured it?
Remarkably well. Every detail is not exactly correct, but the things the game that allows you to do are remarkable. Driving down Broadway, you can see the red cars at the Pacific Electric. You can drive past landmarks like Clifton's Cafeteria and, you know, see its facade as it appeared at the time, not as it currently is, crested in bronze metal. You can do some wonderful things like stroll through the Spring Arcade downtown as it originally was. You can stroll through Pershing Square, you know, when it was still planted with baby palm trees before it was paved over in its recent incarnation. You know, I was able to visit the addresses where people had lived and actually see the buildings where people had actually lived, or at least close approximations of them. You know, one of the classic elements of noir is, of course, the femme fatale. And this is also a game with a femme fatale. Elsa is her somewhat incongruous name. And the rock star people are very secretive about her personality and her story. But I think it's safe to predict that for those of us who want to head to the Sunset Strip and interact with Elsa, there will be ample opportunities to, as long as Detective Cole Phelps plays his cards correctly and moves up the ranks.
Elsa's only available if you're higher up in the ranks at the LAPD.
They were horrified by the notion that I might get to play into the Elsa category. They said, no. None of the gaming press has been allowed to see that. You cannot even refer to it.
You're listening to DNA, and I'm Frances Anderton, talking with author John Bunton about the new video game L.A. Noire, set in 1947 Los Angeles. John is a historian of that era, and while he was generally wowed by the game, he felt that there are a few ways in which the creators were unfaithful to Noir Los Angeles. For example, the skies in the game, he says, are far bluer than the smog-filled skies of actual post-war LA. The streets of downtown are less crowded in the game than they were back then, and the police are less brutal than they could be then. And, he says,
There is a kind of hyper-realism to the entire project, which is striking, but which perhaps in some ways sort of conflicts a little bit with the atmosphere that we more typically expect from noir. The classic film noir, of course, is in black and white. And classic film and noir was also such an incredibly theatrical production. The use of shadow in movies like Touch of Evil or even in the opening scenes of Double Indemnity. It's very staged. And, you know, in some ways, the hyper-realism of the game detracts from that classic noirish atmosphere. Although I hasten to add that the game does have some wonderful night scenes where you really feel like you're back in a Billy Wilder movie.
How fascinating. So really this sounds like the nearest thing to a kind of time travel, you know, something that as children we sort of fantasize about when we read books set in the past and so on. You're saying that the sort of verisimilitude here, the design is quite captivating.
And then that's a frequent metaphor. Simon Wood and Brendan McNamara, the design producer and the game writer and director, like to refer to the game as a kind of time machine. And it's clear that this is a genre blending game. This is a game that's closer to television or film, perhaps, than any other game has been. In fact, this was a game that debuted at the Tribeca Film Festival. And, you know, it's clear that Rockstar here is trying something which is quite distinctive. And the world it takes you into, you know, it is a wonderful, if strangely pastel-colored and smogless and empty version of 1947 Los Angeles. So I fear to predict what the consequences of my productivity will be as I start to enter this world.
And meet Elsa. All manner of troubles will befall you when you meet the femme fatale, John. John Bunton is the author of L.A. Noire, The Struggle for the Soul of America's Most Seductive City, and he's a writer for Governing magazine based in Washington, D.C. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Later in the show, Alyssa Walker walks us through a part of real L.A. But now, L.A. Noire and how Team Bondi created it. They set the game in 8 square miles of Los Angeles, stretching from Boyle Heights, west through downtown and up to Hollywood. Obviously, L.A. has changed enormously since then. For starters, then there was only one freeway, the Arroyo Seco Parkway, now called the Pasadena Freeway. And the team was determined to create a digital LA past that was as accurate as possible. So how did they do it? Simon Wood was the production designer, and he says they spent months here researching its history, starting with poring over thousands of archival photos at UCLA.
It was an Aladdin's cave for us, and certainly for me. We had each photograph scanned in at high res, so we could zoom right in and see the food on the plates, prices on menus, the clothes, the density of the streets. So then we went next door into the geographical department, where we had learned that a collection called Spence, where a man had flown his biplane over the whole of LA and photographed it, almost every square mile of it. So we have some incredible satellite-type photography from its day. Lord knows why he did it, but, you know, for us, thank God he did. So what that gave us was an incredible snapshot of the city, traffic flow, pedestrians, the density, all the buildings. I think the tallest building at the time was City Hall. It was incredible. So we had great satellite-type photography. We had great photojournalism. And so what we needed at that point was a street map. So the Huntington Library in Pasadena has got the actual hand-drawn WPA maps, which were land surveys from the 30s, and they actually drew these wonderful maps showing you what type of residential and commercial areas were there. So what we have at that point now is all the photo reference, and we have a street map, but we don't know the height, the land relief, as it were. So we contacted the US Geological Department, and we obtained a 3D map of LA. And then we overlaid it on top of our WPA maps, and then using all of the elements, the photographs and some of the historical reference that we had written, we then got one of our lead artists, Ben, he then started adjusting the terrain, the landscape of LA, and now we have a 3D model of the whole of Los Angeles.
Now, why was it so important to get such specific level of detail?
Yeah, sorry. So Brendan McNamara is the writer and the director and the owner of Team Bondi. He also has a parent company called Depth Analysis, and these guys are responsible for creating the motion scan heads, these incredible lifelike talking faces. And what we didn't want to do was have an environment that was not as realistic as these faces, because, you know, the people who've seen these faces, it's like film. You can see people raise their eyebrows, lick their lips, they can look around the room. It's incredible. It's never been done before.
Now, presumably, quite a lot of the material that you source, you put quite a lot of your source material was in black and white, but the game is in colour. So how did you determine the colours of your elements?
That was tricky. The first thing we did, I guess, is we've created our photo reference, we've created our maps, and we've stitched it all together. And then we knew from a narrative, from a story point of view, there were certain areas in the map that we wanted to do that would enable us to have great gameplay elements, such as robberies and shootouts in downtown and glamour and nightclubs and, you know, near Hollywood. And so those individual areas did have some photo reference. Not great, but they did have some that was in colour. There was also, I managed to find the original paint samples that were the most commonly used and varnishes that was used at the time from Sears catalogues. I went on eBay and I bought every Sears catalogue, House and Gardens magazines from 1940s to the early 50s, home decorating guides. I also bought architectural journals, and we obtained the actual paint samples, and we also bought these wonderfully old, very smelly wallpaper books. So that was kind of the early reference. And then we actually had a photo team go over to LA and photograph key structures, key buildings, because our game is photorealistic. So to recreate the building, you physically go there and take incredibly high-resolution photographs and then stitch them all together, and they create your canvas that you can then apply to the model in the video game.
How astonishing. And you're recreating a place, but you're also evoking a stylistic genre, a literary genre, a film genre, that of noir. So how did that inform the design of the game?
Well, the thing for me, there's two aspects, I guess. There is the look and the lighting and the colour palette, and then there's obviously the gameplay side and the fact that you're a detective. So what we did is, you know, the traditional expressionist films, they have, you know, out of Germany, they had lots of strong contrast, black and white, and obviously, and they had dramatic shadows. But then later films like Double Indemnity, great film, Big Sleep and so forth, they had a softer approach. And so what we did is we paid homage, I guess, we leant more towards the Big Sleep kind of type films, but we wanted to get as much black and as much contrast in as possible. And we did that through a series of lighting examples I could give you would be we designed all of the locations with what we call practical lights. Practical lights are what they call on films where the light itself is giving you the light in the room. effectively the lighting was for free. And what we mean by that is when you go to, when all of the artwork is assembled, the lights are on, we would deliberately create alcoves and anything would create a shadow. We would never have a flat wall. And shadow is a great thing for us, because if there's a shadow, there's uncertainty. And this plays really well for a detective game.
And Brendan McNamara, he's been quoted apparently as saying that video game technology is only now capable of capturing LA's light. What did he mean by that?
Well, real-time lighting, as what it is, as in it's not rendered out, it is what you see on the time. It replicates film and natural lighting. It's expensive and it's really complicated to do. But when you do it properly, you get incredibly realistic visuals, like Red Dead Redemption, Rockstar's last cowboy game, set out in the West. They have just probably the finest sunsets in the canyons we've ever seen. The skies, and when you try and push real-time lighting, it's because it's so expensive to do, you need strong hardware, and only the current consoles can do this. And, you know, we worked really hard to mimic the LA light, its blue haze, its sunsets, its overall atmosphere, and those golden hour sunsets, but, you know, we think we've got it, but it's incredibly difficult and hard work to do.
Hmm. Now, you've spent a lot of time now in 1947 LA, Simon. What did you like about it? What did you not like so much? And what really surprised you in terms of how LA is now?
I love the formality of the people, the glitz of the glamour of the time. You know, the cars are just stunning. The buildings, the products, I guess, they were designed with a real purpose and passion. Whereas nowadays, everything's a bit generic. You can't tell one car from another. Nothing really, you know, stands out. Everything's almost like a clone of itself. And so when good design and innovation, you know, like Apple's iPhone or Rockstar's Red Dead Redemption, that cowboy game, it's just a breath of fresh air.
Now, Simon, at the start of this interview, you said that before you and your teammates ended up in Sydney, you yourself had yearned to move to LA. Do you still feel that way about LA?
No, it was just what actually happened is when I was a child, I saw the making of The Empire Strikes Back. And I didn't realize there was an art department in films and sketches, and they would draw spaceships. And so I was 8. And then all childhood, I would draw and draw and sketches. And so I always thought I would head into Hollywood and make movies. And in the end, we realized the convergence between film and game was so strong, say 10 or so years ago, that the game industry now is on par. And sometimes it's more influential culturally. And, it's a real medium now. I think the fact that people are used to associate it for children, I think that conversation's long gone, long gone. The people are getting older, you know, the guys who used to play games when they were 10 and now handsome Englishmen in their late 30s. it's a great industry because you see the full range. You start at development and then you massage this whole process for years and you cultivate it and then you release it to the public and, you know, they're anxious times. But thankfully for us, people have really taken to LA Noire.
Well, Simon Wood, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thanks very much for your time. And it's great for us to tell people these backstories that make video games.
Sure.
Thank you.
Simon Wood is the production designer for the new video game LA Noire. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Now, if the idea of spending solitary hours in a hyper-real, crime-splattered version of LA's past is not your thing, you might want to consider a tour instead of real Los Angeles. Coming up this weekend are two walks that take you through some of the streets of our region in all its imperfections and contemporary delights. First off, the Venice Art Walk. That's the annual fundraiser for the Venice Family Clinic. It starts this Friday with an auction of custom-decorated skate decks and surfboards and will be followed on Saturday and Sunday with tours of artist studios and contemporary architects' houses. See our website for details. And on Saturday, DNA and D-Lab are presenting a walking tour of West Hollywood. It's in memory of John Chase, a dear friend and astute writer of books about Los Angeles, and a longtime urban designer for the city of West Hollywood, who passed away last year. Using smarts and an exuberant personality, John worked with the often arduous planning process to help shape the fabric of West Hollywood, from signage on Sunset Boulevard to widening sidewalks and planting trees on Santa Monica Boulevard to shepherding striking multifamily buildings by such architects as Lorcan O'Herlihy and Patrick Tai. The tour will stretch over the day. It will include readings of his work by fans and friends of John and stop-offs at his favourite eateries. Alyssa Walker of Good, D-Lab and DNA produced the event, and I asked her to give us some of the highlights.
Well, I think we'll start with the expected places. I think everybody drives through West Hollywood and you kind of take these two parallel journeys through either Santa Monica Boulevard or down Sunset Boulevard. And just like me, and I think a lot of other people, we kind of sail through these parts of the city without really understanding why it came to be, why it looks the way it does, why West Hollywood it looks different from the rest of the city and is kind of its own urban language, if you will. And I think what we'll be able to show is how the city has evolved and what makes it different and special within the fabric of Los Angeles.
So what are some of the individual places that the tour will stop off at?
Well, you mentioned some of the unique housing projects that we're going to be featuring on the tour. Formosa 1140, Habitat 825, the Sierra Bonita Affordable Housing Project, Palmview Apartments. These are all showing this wonderful possibility for multifamily dwellings that occur. You know, we often think of these bungalows in Los Angeles. We all have our little single family houses with a yard. And these just have shown the amazing possibilities when you can take a multifamily housing structure and turn it into this architectural triumph that really adds to the street.
And what about eateries?
Well, John loved to eat, and since he worked in the middle of the city right at West Hollywood City Hall, he got to go to a lot of places around the city and try them out first. He was in charge of bringing a lot of these eateries to West Hollywood and making sure that they had beautiful homes to operate out of. So we'll be looking at some of the restaurants like Food Lab, Salt's Cure, Crown Bar, Bar Lubitsch. These are all newer places that John helped bring to the city, as well as some of his old-time favorites like Barney's Beanery and Mel's Drive-In, which he actually helped to protect. If you look at Mel's Drive-In up on Sunset Boulevard, it's this kind of funny, googie building, looks very mid-century, and he helped them convince the owners that they needed to actually protect the building instead of changing the way it looked.
Well, Alyssa, this sounds great. Really looking forward to the walk on Saturday. Any last words you want to add?
Just to RSVP through the link. We'll have it on the DNA website. And even if you can't join us for the entire tour, we'll give you information on where to join up. And we'll also be tweeting along the way so you can find us if you just want to stop in for a few minutes. We'll have a lot of surprises too, a lot of guest speakers and a lot of people who are excited to welcome us into their buildings and projects to see the legacy that John left behind.
Alyssa Walker is an editor at Good, founder of D-Lab, and an associate producer of DNA. That's it for today's show. It was produced by Ray Guana. The consulting producer is Jennifer Farrow. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website, and to the very talented Olga Kazan, who sadly leaves us after several months interning with DNA. To comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/DNA, where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening to the show, and join me again next month for more DNA.